From CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, this is UBC Arts On Air. We're your hosts, Brittany Dugan
and Rachel Sanders. On each program, we feature the ideas and stories of students, faculty, and staff within the Faculty of Arts at the University of British Columbia. This evening, we're speaking with Dr. Catherine Harrison about pipelines and politics.
Dr. Harrison is a political science professor. She's also acting dean of arts here at UBC.
We dropped by her office last Wednesday, and that was the day the BC government approved the environmental assessment for Kinder Morgan's Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion project. You're a professor of political science, but you were originally pursuing a PhD in chemical engineering. Why did you switch your field of study?
I think like a lot of students, I always had pretty diverse interests. So I was interested in technical questions, but also social issues. And partway through my PhD in engineering, I became, my interest shifted, I think, partly because I concluded that the most immediate challenge was not lack of human ingenuity, but lack of a policy framework that would prompt private sector companies to innovate and to adopt technologies that already exist.
So you think that policy plays an important role in the adoption or the developing of clean energy?
Absolutely. Fossil fuels are wonderfully easy ways to get energy for pretty cheap. You know, digging coal out of the ground and burning it is a pretty low-cost operation. One can get pretty inexpensive energy doing that. So it's only once we adopt policies that take into account the social and environmental costs of those activities that we take into account the true costs and change the incentives for the private sector or public sector.
Now, we've just heard today the BC government has approved an environmental assessment for Kinder Morgan's Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion project. What are your thoughts on that?
It's not a surprise. The writing has been increasingly clear on the wall in the last few months. And, of course, the federal government has already approved the project, and Premier Clark indicated that the provincial government was very close. We also knew that they had a deadline, you know, within the next week to 10 days that they had to respond and make a decision. So it's not a surprise. It is interesting that the provincial government was able to get financial concessions from Kinder Morgan, $25 to $50 million per year for 20 years, which I don't know if it's the first time that's ever been done, probably not, but it's an interesting development in recent history, I think. And kind of surprised, though, that the premier was talking about how this wasn't our project to approve, it's the federal government's project, which is an odd turn of phrase when her government was announcing approval of the project. I mean, they did issue a BC approval.
So why did she say that, do you think?
Well, I think it's passing the buck for something that will be unpopular in many quarters in British Columbia.
The Prime Minister, Trudeau, approved the pipeline as well. How does that decision fit in with his environmental actions or policies or decisions overall?
Politically, I think it was a very successful strategy of really the federal government saying two quite incompatible things and making everyone happy in so doing. So on one hand, we will reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. We've been one of the leaders in committing to an international agreement to limit climate change to 2 degrees C. And on the other hand, proposing continued expansion of Canada's fossil fuel industry, and associated with that, increasing economic reliance of Canada's economy on oil exports. So those strike me as incompatible things, but politically, it was a very effective strategy. It had something for everyone, something for Alberta. The eastern Canadian provinces feel like there's probably less pressure for energy east. The BC government got Pacific Northwest LNG and has now made an additional deal for financial support for the provincial government from Kinder Morgan. So politically, I think it's worked out pretty well in most of the country for the federal government. In practical terms, I think it's very difficult to reconcile expanding fossil fuel production and fossil fuel exports, both domestically, the scale of increases in emissions from Pacific Northwest LNG, the Kinder Morgan expansion, and Line 3, the three projects that have been approved by the federal government this fall, the increases in emissions from those offset almost exactly the benefits from the $50 carbon price. So it's hard to meet our targets if we are expanding emissions. And in fact, the federal plan that was announced in December doesn't achieve Canada's 2030 target. There's a shortfall. And it's not clear how we'll meet that. And that shortfall will get bigger the longer these projects operate, because the 30% reduction target by 2030 is just the first step. We have to go further and further to, you know, say 80% by 2050. It's also difficult to reconcile in international terms, because we are basically doubling down on reliance on export of fossil fuels at a time when in other settings we're talking about moving the world away from fossil fuels. So in certain international fora, we are bargaining to put our industry out of business and at the same time approving new infrastructure that's expected to operate for 20 or more years to export fossil fuels. And the final bit of that is one of the ways that Canada may close the gap in its 2030 emissions targets is by purchasing international credits, basically paying other countries to make reductions. And that can be a very cost-effective way to achieve one's goals. But it makes a whole lot less sense if what you're effectively doing is paying other countries not to buy your own oil exports, which at the limit is one of the potential consequences.
Okay, how do you think Canada should be moving forward with climate policy?
I think if we're serious about a 2C target, and we know that the global economic modeling of what would the world look like in a 2C target suggests that very rapidly reliance on unconventional oil, such as Canada's tar sands, would disappear. If we know that and we are committed to a 2C future, I think we should be investing our money and our energy and our policy development in thinking of ways to transition Canada's economy from relying so heavily on fossil fuels. And that's not the same thing as shutting down Canada's fossil fuel industries overnight. That's often suggested that that's what people are saying, and I haven't heard anyone say that. But what these new projects are doing is actually expanding our fossil fuel industry. It's transitioning in the other direction. And so at a minimum, if you want to reduce reliance on fossil fuels, you need to reduce reliance on fossil fuels.
How do jobs figure in here? Alberta's had a hard time recently. People are suffering. How do we balance the need for jobs with the need for clean energy solutions?
I think that's why governments are so bad at this. It's that politically, people know what their current jobs are. And even if you anticipate that the number of jobs created in an economic transition will be greater, no one knows that that's their job. So existing jobs carry tremendous political weight. And we've seen how badly federal and provincial governments in Canada have done, given how heavily we rely on fossil fuel related jobs. I think we need to start talking about the need for a transition. We need to start planning worker retraining programs. We need to think about regional movement, because many of those jobs are in remote places, in small towns, where that isn't necessarily the same place that the new jobs will be. And that's a very difficult thing for in the Canadian context as well. There's no question that the Alberta economy has suffered, and there have been a lot of layoffs. There's a high rate of unemployment, and so people are very worried about jobs in that region in particular. But I think if we take a step back and ask ourselves, what happened to those jobs? The reason, for the most part, that they were lost is that the price of oil fell. And Canada's relatively high cost of production oil was no longer economically competitive. There was plenty of conventional oil in Saudi Arabia once they opened the taps, and they were basically able to take the jobs away from Canada. That's exactly what we would expect to see happen as the countries of the world pursue reductions in their greenhouse gas emissions and thus reduce demand for oil. When oil demand declines, there will be plenty of low-cost oil that's available. Unconventional oil like Canada's will be the first oil to go. And so I think we need to think about was this a shot across the bow that we should take as a warning sign that it's time to invest in creating other jobs rather than trying to salvage jobs that we know are vulnerable? They're vulnerable to competition from conventional producers, and we've just seen that. They're vulnerable in the same ways from climate policy, and maybe we should take this as a warning and act on it rather than a signal to double down on investing in more jobs in the oil industry.
You're involved in a new climate course here at UBC this term, leading the way towards a low-carbon future. How did that course come about?
It came about through a combination of things. First, there was a call for proposals, and there's funding available for this project through the Trudeau Foundation. And then the initiative came from a colleague, not me, Naoko Ellis, who is a professor of chemical engineering, and we have collaborated a little bit on some teaching about climate policy in the past. So it was her initiative. She brought together a team, and I'm helping with that, but I certainly don't deserve the credit for getting it off the ground, nor doing most of the work, I'm afraid.
Hey, what's the purpose of the course?
It has a number of purposes. It is a graduate level course, although there's a few fourth year students who have received permission to participate. And the idea is to bring together an interdisciplinary group of students to learn from each other. We want students to be exposed to other perspectives, other disciplinary perspectives on climate change. I think that's particularly important for anyone who studies climate change. You can't do it within a silo. And just the nature of the issue is so broad and touches on everything. So partly we just want to encourage students to gain deeper insight in other areas. The other focus of the course is on public scholarship, thinking about how do I, as an expert, you know, a graduate student, say, doing a PhD in some field, talk to a broader community, colleagues in other disciplines, but also the public at large, because it is something that is increasingly important for scholars everywhere, but I think especially working on the issue of climate change, to be able to talk to people like you, to talk to their neighbors, and to think about, you know, how can that conversation be informed by our understanding of social psychology, our understanding of effective communication. So some of that will be built into the course as well.
As you said, this is an incredibly complex issue. It's hard for people to get their heads around. What's the most important thing you'd like UBC students to understand about the politics of climate change?
You know, I think that as a political science professor, I'm very good at explaining all the reasons why we've failed to address this issue. And it is a particularly difficult political issue because it's kind of all of these challenges come together. There's a need for intergenerational investment. We have to make changes today that will benefit people who aren't yet alive. There are winners and losers. The losers make a big fuss in politics. There really is scientific uncertainty, not about whether climate change is real or not, but a lot of the details of what can be done and when and where the impacts will be felt. There's a global scale collective action problem. Any individual country acting absent a similar commitment to action from other countries will be, you know, especially for a small country, next to futile. Climate change will still happen at almost the same rate. And so it is a massive challenge, and we've done pretty badly at it. And I guess it's at a certain point, it needs to be individual citizens that just demand more. And one of the reasons we've done badly is every individual voter says, what's in it for me? What am I willing to spend? Am I willing to pay more for gasoline in order to benefit people who aren't born yet? Am I willing to support a government that proposes a carbon tax? And so at the end of the day, unless voters are really willing to back up politicians who do the things that need to be done, if we're just content to blame them, nothing's going to happen, and they're going to continue giving us symbolic policies and inconsistent policies. And I think that's a particularly challenging lesson for young people, because voters under 30 have the lowest rates of participation. And, you know, many young people are participating in public debates through things like social media and Twitter and so on. And they may protest. But at the end of the day, if people don't vote and they don't vote in favor of parties or in favor of governments that are proposing to do the things that are effective, we will continue to fail.
So vote is your, yeah. Your own kids, you said, are climate activists, environmental activists. What other advice do you have for students who want to get involved and try and make change?
And the environmental community has in many ways changed its strategies in dealing with climate change, and they've returned to the grassroots. They're knocking on doors. They're having face-to-face conversations with voters because there's a recognition that just lobbying the politicians isn't going to do it. There needs to be transformation of political attitudes. And I think there are tons of opportunities for citizens who want to engage in those conversations to volunteer for many different environmental groups that exist. There's UBC C350 on this campus. There's Dogwood and Lead Now, and I'm sure the Sierra Club, and you know, there's a host of organizations. I think pursuing a career in that area can be more of a challenge because there's a lot more jobs in the tar sands than there are in the environmental community. But a lot of people get started as volunteers. They gain insight by doing that. And at the same time, they're learning, they're taking courses, they're pursuing theses and so on. And that, you know, I have several graduate students who have worked with me who have really fulfilling careers in the nonprofit environmental community or working for governments or international organizations like the OECD.
Thank you very much, Dr. Harrison, for speaking with us today.
You're very welcome.
That was Dr. Catherine Harrison, political science professor and acting dean of arts.
As Dr. Harrison says, there are lots of ways to get active on the issue of climate change. Most importantly, get out and exercise your right to vote.
And keep an eye out for the international lecture series that's associated with the course Leading the Way Towards a Low-Carbon Future. You can find out more about that at the website lowcarbonfuture.ubc.ca. Those are coming up this term, and they promise some new perspectives on this issue.
If you missed some of that interview, you can visit our website at artsonair.com. We'll be posting the podcast there tomorrow.
Okay, give me a standby too, please.
And a standby for actors. So, reset. Everyone ready?
Are we good?
Go again.
We went behind the scenes last week. It was backstage of the theater department's latest production. That's called Love and Information. It's by British playwright Carol Churchill.
And it's directed by MFA theater directing candidate Lauren Taylor. Lauren walked us through the 90-minute play that has over 60 scenes, features 120 characters, there's something like 400 sound cues and hundreds of costumes and props. And she sat down with us before one of the final rehearsals last week. I wondered how it was decided that this year's production would be Carol Churchill's Love and Information. Was that your choice?
We have to, as MFA candidates, put forward three proposals for main stage productions, and then there is a committee that decides on which one of those three they think would best serve the Frederick Wood Theatre community, as well as the Faculty of Theatre and Film. So yeah, I put forward three and this is the one that they chose. So I'm super excited because it was my first choice too.
Why was it your first choice?
I just found it so immediate when I first read it. I thought it was written in 2012, but it still feels so current, contemporary right now. So many of these situations really jumped out at me. They seem to be so urgent and all involve a relationship where the stakes are pretty high. People want something from the other person. I thought, wow, this is amazing. And I think reading through the whole thing, it's got themes that keep popping up to do with meaning and human behavior and memory and interpretation and what it is to be human right now, that I just found really interesting and kind of just gripped me by the throat, really.
I imagine quite relevant for students to have the opportunity to act in this when there are so many characters. There's over 100.
That's correct. There's over 100 characters. There is 60 scenes, and none of the scenes repeat a character. So they're all unique somebodies that are sort of traveling through this world. But there's no overarching uber narrative. And yeah, like I said, we never meet these people for longer than probably 3 minutes. So it's got a real immediacy and presence for that reason. And when I first read it, I just thought, whoa, it's like Twitter theater or something. It's just like these little snippets of really intimate moments where the stakes are really high. And there was something, I don't know, they just sort of carry you on this wave and then leave you and then the next thing starts. And so it's a pretty all-encompassing experience. But I think it adds up to... what will probably be a different experience for every single audience member, which also excites me, like leaving the interpretive side of the piece slightly open for folks to bring their own lives to the show as well, if that makes sense. So,
I know that this play isn't that old, it's only 4 years, and so it probably wasn't a super stretch to make characters really relevant, but were there any characters that stand out that you really updated to be very 2017?
Oh, that's an interesting question. it was a little difficult to avoid what we're living through right now, which is obviously an especially charged time in US politics, but also global politics. So we have made reference to that. Interestingly, every scene has a title, and Carol Churchill has organised it in seven sections. And within that those seven sections, she says you can order the scenes in any way you'd like. However, she stipulates that the last scene is a scene called Facts, F-A-C-T-S. And to me, I'm just constantly amazed at how relevant her themes are in 2017. So Facts obviously is hot right now in terms of public discourse and the importance of facts versus feelings, what emphasis do we place on facts, how do we interpret meaning from things, one person's version versus another person's version. All these things are sort of raised in the play in these vignettes.
And I wondered what connects, like, your research here at UBC to Carol's work. It sounds like a very rich foundation to do some research in your directing work. What have you found?
Well, I've always loved plays that deal with form as well as theme and content. So one of the things that I love about Carol Churchill is she seems to have this, a thing that, you know, people like Margaret Atwood have as well. I call it this kind of witchy woman instinct to just kind of grab the zeitgeist of the moment and broadcast it or deal with questions and thematic concerns in her work. And so, obviously researching Carol Churchill has been very rich for me. I think working with a female writer has been really wonderful. She's one of the few writers that seem to operate and navigate lots of different worlds with a lot of strength and power, but without compromising her unique voice, which I find really interesting. She's sort of stuck to her guns. Interestingly, she also she doesn't do any press. She says that kind of, she can't think of her next ideas if she talks about what she's worked on.
So she doesn't do interviews, she doesn't talk about her work?
Not since the 80s.
Were you able to talk to her before directing this?
I unfortunately, no. No, I wasn't. She's 78 and still going strong. But no, I don't have an in with Carol Churchill, unfortunately.
In a way, do you think that gave you more freedom? I know that this play actually you had a lot of freedom in deciding what order it would be, and there's some scenes in which she lets you just say, well, put them wherever you'd like. What was that like?
It was kind of really thrilling and daunting at the same time. So the text is written almost like a piece of poetry. There are no character names. There's no indication of gender or age or setting even. There's very few stage directions. So you're sort of reading this thing that looks like a poem, but you can see it's a dialogue. And most of them are between two people. And I've made some choices where I've added extra people in a couple of the scenes. But most of them are two-handers. So going back to what you said, it's ideal for students, especially acting students, because they're all fueled scenes. They're very active. It's very sort of active writing because she's a genius at scenes. But it was daunting initially because I had to come up with the given circumstances based on what we found in the text for every single scenario. So they were almost like mini playlets. So I had to say, right, this person is, this relationship is an aunt and a niece, and they are at the aunt's cabin, and it is on an island, or, you know, this relationship is between two people who are dance partners. And so that was that took a lot of work initially, and we also obviously had to come up with costuming ideas for all of them, so the design team has featured, you know, really heavily in the creative process of this.
Yeah, I was going to ask what kind of scenic and production elements were made unique to this version, your version.
Well, one of the big decisions with this play is, do you set it in a series of ever-changing scenarios, or do you set it in one world and just make it a nondescript world? And so we went with the option that each scene is located in a different place and different scenario. So trying to be economical with set pieces and furniture and props, like using the bare minimum to convey a sense of where these people might be and what they might be doing. For example, we've got two characters that are in sitting in a hockey game. And so we've just got two plastic chairs and some beer cups, but they're wearing Canucks jerseys, and the sound effects are da-da-da-da-da, you know, a hockey game kind of music. So they're the kind of design pieces, costume, sound, and set that we piece together that are fairly simple but can be struck in, you know, 10 seconds.
So here we are walking backstage.
This is the beginning of the props table that extends the entire length of the theatre. So you'll see...
Justin Bieber magazine.
There's a typewriter, there's peanut butter, there's... oh my goodness, what have we got? A doctor's stethoscope, we've got a flashlight, we've got a Halloween pumpkin, we've got walking poles, a rose in a vase, a Donald Trump magazine, a baby in a blanket.
And so as we're walking from left to right, and these are scene numbers, or 6.77, like everything's documented on tape here. Yep. And organized.
Yeah, there's a place for everything. And so Saturday we'll run our first technical rehearsal, and I feel like now is where all of my research and learning comes into play, because when I first see it all together with light and sound, that's when I make the rhythmic fine-tuning adjustments, you know, cut a couple of seconds off here, add a couple of seconds there, and that's where you can sort of control the emotional content of the piece a bit more, and also, you know, work with the actors to highlight the thematic concerns even more. So to me, I feel like this is the most thrilling time, and it's also where things, oh my gosh, like, you know, change. 24 hours can feel like a year in terms of your understanding and your finessing of the work. So yeah.
Right.
Hundreds and hundreds of hours to come to this point.
Well, we look forward to it. Best of luck.
Thank you so much.
That was MFA Theatre Directing candidate Lauren Taylor. She's directing Love and Information, which opens this week on Thursday, January 19th, at the Frederick Wood Theatre here on campus. Love and Information runs until February 4th.
It was so fun to be backstage and see all the props and costumes. You know, with over 100 characters, it sounds like a pretty complex play, but Lauren says there's a lot of heart in it. It's all about human connection.
Yeah, it reminds me a lot of one of my favorite pieces by a Swedish choreographer named Mats Ek, and his piece called Appartement. That dance looked at the many lives of people all living in this one apartment building, their stories of love and loss, and just a general dynamic and intimacy of private relationships and realities in such a close proximity. This play seems universal in a similar way.
You've been listening to UBC Arts on Air on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. If you'd like more information about our program, check out our website. That's artsonair.com.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about the show. Email us at artsonair.info@gmail.com or tweet us at artsonair.
Thanks for listening. See you next time.